I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. LBJ and MLK, president and protest leader, formed an abrasive, mismatched alliance to pass the Voting Rights Act 50 years ago. The pairing was made for the ages and now for the Oscar-nominated movie Selma. Between the white politician from Texas and the black preacher from Georgia, feelings ran so high and Johnson's barnyard language so low that the subject is still sore to the touch. But it was not about manners. Did President Johnson bully Dr. King? LBJ bullied everybody. Have we forgotten what he unleashed on Vietnam, which was becoming an American war at very nearly the same Selma moment? Vietnam was where the LBJ-MLK split went wide open and is still a provocation. A difference, really, about who we Americans think we are. We're prompted to this history hour by Selma the movie and by an equally arresting new book, American Reckoning, by our first guest, Christian Appy, professor of history at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. His subtitle is The Vietnam War and Our National Identity. Doris Kearns Goodwin is also part of our conversation, serial best-selling historian whose career began taking notes morning after morning from Lyndon Johnson himself on his nightmares in retirement at the ranch. Also, the acclaimed presidential biographer Robert Dalek, who joins us from California, and with us in the WBUR studio, the historian Chad Williams, chairman of African American Studies at Brandeis University. Christian Appy, we begin with you because it was your book about Vietnam in the 60s, still resonating, that sharpened all the connections here. This movie, Selma, revisits the incredibly fruitful tension between MLK and LBJ. And we never stop puzzling about the good LBJ and the bad LBJ, but what we forget, and you remind us of, is the simultaneity of all these things. The blood on the bridge in Selma, Alabama, and the Marines landing in Vietnam. I've got to say, Chris Appy, I read your book in two sittings, blood boiling all the way, about what we have lost in our lifetime, and it's deeply serious. It was not all LBJ, but he embodied so much of it. Start from the top and take us on that ride.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me. Well, you know, when LBJ became president after Kennedy was assassinated, he felt very strongly that even if this were an impossible war to win, and the longer he extended it, the more advice he was getting saying it really was an impossible situation. He nevertheless was convinced to his bones that it was a war he should not and could not afford to lose or withdraw from, or it would be political suicide. He had fully internalized the lessons of the darkest days of the Cold War, and he well remembered how much the Democrats had been beat up on back, all going all the way back to 1949 when the Chinese communists came to power and the Republicans, said, who lost China? And it must have been Truman. It must have been somebody in high, places in government. So LBJ really had internalized that. And in my own opinion, he just did not have ultimately the moral courage to stand in opposition to it. And so he escalated into a war. He told his own national security advisor, George Bundy, he didn't see how he could win. I mean, there's this amazing phone call that he had with Bundy in 1964 where he said, I'll just give you a little piece of it. He says, I don't think we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere. I don't think it's worth fighting, and I don't think we can get out. It's just the biggest damn mess that I ever saw. What the hell am I ordering those kids out there for? What the hell is Vietnam worth to me? What's it worth to the country? But even lacking confidence in the ability to achieve the objective of creating a permanent non-communist South Vietnam, he went ahead with it anyway, and as you say, started to escalate it massively beginning almost exactly 50 years ago, not just with ground troops, but with massive bombing.
It's one of the striking threads through this book. I mean, it's a river of threads that Bundy had said the same thing to himself and to Johnson. He went out there in, 65, and he said, we're losing.
Right.
And again, similar in Bundy language, which is entirely different from Johnson language. What are we doing here? This can't be won. But he ended up saying, we've got to do it for our own sense of position in the world or something. All these contradictions Robert McNamara, very much the same kind of, you know, train wreck in his own mind. What's the problem? It's deeper than in rational analysis.
Yeah, it really does come down to international and domestic appearances. I mean, you're right about Bundy. He did write this famous memo to Johnson in which he recommended the systematic daily bombing of North Vietnam, but told him that the odds of success could not be determined. You know, it might be 25%, 75%, and might even fail. But if it does fail, he goes on to say, it would be worth it because it would prove that we did everything we had to prevent a communist takeover, and this would be crucial to, you know, our credibility and our prestige around the world and at home. So, you know, which to me is just really appalling that that their own personal and the nation, what they thought of the nation's reputation, was more important than whether or not they could even achieve the objectives or whether the objectives were worth achieving.
But of course, it was reputation that we lost above all.
Right, and that's why, yes, I mean, you know, it's strange, not only is it a moral failure, but I would argue that it was a colossal political miscalculation from the most political of all presidents. I mean, he was convinced that it would ruin his presidency, and yet the war did ultimately bring down his presidency. He withdrew from the 1968 campaign before it ever really got began to be waged, and because of the war. So, I mean, I honestly think that even politically, had he chosen to get out, it might have rescued his presidency. There was this famous moment when Senator Fulbright had hearings that were televised. It was a big deal, you know, 30 million viewers in 1966. And Fulbright was an extraordinary chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I mean, we've never had before or since a senator of that prestige in foreign policy who would ever think to write a book called The Arrogance of American Power, which is what he did, and it sold 400,000 copies. He questioned a whole bunch of people, including some of the first architects of the policy of containment, you know, for the Cold War, especially this guy, George Kennan. And at one point they asked him, what would happen if we withdrew from Vietnam? This is 1966. And he said, well, it would be like probably a six-month sensation. It really wouldn't have a long-term effect on our politics, both at home or abroad. But Johnson, of course, clearly didn't believe it. He thought it would be a disaster, that he would be you know, eviscerated by not just the Republicans, but by members of his own party.
You know, there's so many contradictions here. It's nothing but contradiction. But start with the rationales for this war underway, which make you sick now, literally sick. The best minds in America telling us we were doing the Vietnamese a favor, or that this was economic development by another name, or
right,
instant urbanization.
Right. Well,
Go ahead.
Well, one of the things that I try to recover in this book, which I think is now sort of lost to us, is that broad faith in the 1950s, well into the early 60s, that America was a force for good in the world, that we're always the good guys, we always stood for democracy and freedom, and there was, of course, broad faith and trust in the government. All the polls showed that. And so when they said that we were there to preserve democracy and prevent communist aggression, people, basically most people, swallowed it. And it took. That's why it took so long for the anti-war movement to sort of understand how they had been deceived and even lied to in the past. And most obvious, you know, to pick an early example that contradicts this idea about democracy, there were supposed to have been elections held in 1956. These were internationally sanctioned elections called for by the Geneva Accords,
right,
that would bring Vietnam reunited as one country under one government. And we, the United States, along with Ngo Dinh Diem, the man we were backing in South Vietnam as we tried to build a permanent non-communist South Vietnam, we blocked those elections. We said they can't happen. And the reason is simple. Eisenhower understood that if they were held, Ho Chi Minh, the communist leader in Vietnam, would almost certainly have won an overwhelming victory.
He said 80% chance, yeah.
Yeah, 80%. He said it in his own memoirs in 63. Yeah, so, you know, that came to light, and that was part of it. And then the other thing was people began to be aware of just how ruthlessly we were prosecuting that war, particularly in the South, which that's really where the war was primarily fought. And, you know, it was the South that we claimed to be defending against aggression. And Americans began to realize, well, you know, to use that famous slogan, we were destroying the country we were claiming to be saving.
Yeah. Chris Hoppe, there are two marvelous lines, many lines, good lines in your book, but two leap off the page. And they're both written by fiction guys. And they could be the thematic lines in your book. One from Robert Stone in Dog Soldiers in 1974. The character says, "We didn't know who we were till we got here. We thought we were something else." The other one is Tim O'Brien, whom we know well, in a short story about a young man in the Midwest, himself, obviously, who's tortured by the temptation to run into Canada and avoid the draft. The last line of the story, and you quote it beautifully, he confesses, "I was a coward. I went to the war."
Yeah, I think that what strikes me is that millions of Americans went through this sort of profound and wrenching moral self-questioning and awakening, and took personal moral responsibility for their actions in a way that was quite profound. And in the book, I actually pair that passage that you just quoted with Tim O'Brien alongside a passage that Doris Kearns Goodwin knows better than I. When she interviewed LBJ, he talked about this nightmare, feeling that he would be a coward, be seen as an unmanly man, lacking spine if he got out. Whereas Tim O'Brien didn't pity himself that way. He said, yeah, I heard those same voices and I was a coward.
But of course, in hindsight and with a tiny bit of psychological imagination, it's so clear that the cowardly thing for LBJ and all the others was just to hang into this hopeless, ego-mad war. The courageous thing would have been to say, "This is a loser, and we're going to come back and look after our own country." Don't go away, Christian Hoppe. Coming up, Doris Kearns Goodwin, early close-up biographer of Lyndon Johnson. It was her husband, Dick Goodwin, who wrote the famous speech that LBJ delivered right after Selma. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Rethinking LBJ and MLK, Selma and Vietnam, oceans apart, but linked in time and ironies and resonances to this day. Doris Kearns Goodwin might be the most popular writer in the land about public men on the grand scale, Churchill's and Kennedy's, the two Roosevelt presidents, and the solitary Lincoln. Her first big book began with transcribing the stream of Lyndon Johnson's memory at the LBJ Ranch in Stonewall, Texas, in the early 1970s. This week, I asked Doris Goodwin to help us get our heads and our hearts around the unlikely principles in this story, MLK and LBJ.
The history for MLK will be a positive one in terms of both his passionate concern for civil rights and his passionate worry about imperialism and racism abroad. For LBJ, what I think is happening now, and rightfully so, is that at least because the last decades, Vietnam has been absolutely the most important thing on the radar screen when people thought about him, the 50-year anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Great Society speech has put a rightful memory on people's minds now of what he did accomplish in civil rights, not only civil rights, but social justice. I mean, the Great Society, the War on Poverty, Elementary and Secondary Education Act, Higher Ed, Appalachian Relief, HUD, probably, you know, paralleling the New Deal and FDR, and on civil rights, paralleling or close to Abraham Lincoln. And yet, of course, there was that war. I mean, of course, I knew him in the early days when I was in the anti-war movement. When I think about it, there I was in my 20s, sitting across from him, talking about the war, not understanding the war even then, and seeing the feelings of what he had accomplished already in the past, since I was there in 67, 68, 69, and 70. So those great glory years were part of history then. Now that history's come more alive, rightly so, but the war remains. And the war remains a sorrowful eyes looking back at that time for our country, for him, and really for the world in some ways.
Do you see him as one guy after all these years, Doris?
No, he's certainly one person. I mean, especially when you listen to the tapes and you realize that this is what's so sad in 64, 65, early on just saying, why are we there? What are we doing? What are we going to do there? Not wanting to get there, unlike the person I thought I was yelling about, hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? And yet somehow, however, with all of his passion being for poverty and civil rights, that's the one guy still, once he got into this war, did not have the courage to get us out, did not have a Congress. I mean, he was so great in domestic politics in part because he knew how to deal with Congress. He knew how to create a debate. He knew how to get the country involved to mobilize itself for civil rights and poverty. In foreign policy, our presidents have too much power in some ways, perhaps, and those policies were never debated fully in the Congress until finally there were hearings, but by then we were so stuck in the war we couldn't get out. And so I think it's not that there's two different guys, a bad guy and a good guy. It's somebody who was so skilled in one arena, which was the domestic arena, and foreign policy. I mean, he really did believe at times if he could give Ho Chi Minh what he wanted, dams and public works projects, war might come to an end. Who didn't understand the importance of making sure the public knew it was a long sustained war because he wanted to keep the Great Society going. He didn't want that war to be front and center. So the very things he loved domestically are what hurt him when he tried to deal with foreign policy. So it's the same person, but with skills in one arena and sorrowful parts in the other.
It's strange, it seems to me, that the criticism of the movie turns on this portrayal of LBJ as rude and crude and maybe racist, patronizing, difficult, moody, self-centered, blah, blah, blah. We all knew that, and I'm sure Martin Luther King knew all of that, but it left the more consequential both harmony on civil rights and wide difference on Vietnam almost out of the consideration. You know what I mean?
The most important part, I think, that the movie missed was that this was, at the time of Selma, a partnership that allowed both Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement and the government to do something historic, to do something great. My husband wrote a column, Dick Goodwin did recently, on this for the Washington Post, where he talked about the fact that the big changes in our history always occur when you have an outside movement pushing in, whether it's the anti-slavery movement, creating the Republican Party, creating the chance for Lincoln, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the gay rights movement. All of those movements come from the outside, but at some point, somebody inside has to be there to make the way and open the door. And what was sad about the movie was that would have been a great partnership to show. And even the We Shall Overcome speech, which is part of the movie, wasn't delivered with the fervor that LBJ delivered it. It was a moment that was a black and a white moment, a transcendent American moment, neither black nor white, as Dick said. And that's one of those great moments in American history, and you want to celebrate it. And by not allowing LBJ his rightful place on the stage with Martin Luther King at that moment, at that time, that's what wasn't fair.
How grave an unfairness, even in your own heart, your own knowledge of the man.
Well, I think what hurt the most was this was his conviction. He wanted this Voting Rights Act passed. It was only in 64 when he passed the Civil Rights Act with his huge conviction and his ability to deal with Congress and Everett Dirksen and getting the Republicans on board that he said then that we couldn't do voting rights in 64. But by 65, he'd already put it into the State of the Union. He knew that there had to be pressure from the outside. That pressure came, and he responded magnificently with that speech. And then months later, the Voting Rights Act passes. So they missed a great moment. And there was no reason to do it, especially, you know, now with everything going on with Staten Island and Ferguson and so much racial tension in the country. We could have celebrated one of those moments in history when blacks and whites worked together to produce something historic. And that's what made me sad. Some part of that movie, I loved watching the march. I mean, loved watching the march is an odd thing to say because it was so sad to watch the brutality, but they captured the factions within the civil rights movement. They captured the South, those towns in the South. The cinematography was terrific. You know, and had that partnership been there, I think it could have been a movie for the ages.
Didn't Dick write that We Shall Overcome speech? Wasn't that Dick's work?
It was indeed. And I think he would be the first to say it. There was so little time to work on it because Johnson decided on a Sunday night that he was going to give a speech to the joint session of Congress on Monday night. So normally, as you know, when a speech is worked over by 20 people over 20 days, it gets watered down. But there was only that day. There was LBJ and my husband. And those words are extraordinary. You know, at times history and fate meet at a certain time at a certain place. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was at Appomattox.
In a single place. to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama. What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
That was first Doris Kearns Goodwin and then LBJ reading Dick Goodwin's speech text before Congress 50 years ago. Robert Dalek is with us on the line from San Diego, prolific and wise biographer of FDR, JFK, Nixon, and Kissinger. He wrote almost 800 pages on, as he said, the flawed giant, Lyndon Johnson. Bob Dalek, welcome. Doris Goodwin says LBJ was one man, but was there ever a more contradictory character?
Yeah, I think, Chris, he was terribly contradictory. But, you know, I think she captures the moment, the current moment, so accurately when she says that the movie should have been more historically accurate, because, you know, he was determined to give African Americans voting rights. His understanding was that without voting rights, they were never going to achieve a kind of equality in this country, or the equality of opportunity that we guide ourselves by in the United States. So, I mean, there was something terribly positive about it. But, you know, by the same token, Vietnam crippled so much of what he wanted to do. And I think in listening to the conversation earlier, I think what I would add to it is that somehow he and Bundy and certainly Walt Rostow and McNamara, they couldn't believe that these little guys running around the jungles in black pajamas could stand up to American military might. Mm. That once you put troops in there, which of course happened in great numbers in July of 1965, for all Johnson's doubts, at bottom, I think, somehow he believed that we could defeat them. And as it became clearer and clearer that we couldn't do it, I think he became much more disillusioned and frustrated, and of course leading him in 1968 decide that he couldn't run again because the opposition of the country to him was so pronounced.
Bob Dalek, stand back just 50 years hindsight in plain language. What do you think drove that man and all this? Was it the war party? Was it something about American macho? Was it something in his own psyche from the beginning? Personal fears, personal ghosts? What accounts for it?
Well, Chris, I think it's all those things. He was a very complicated man and a brilliant politician, but he made a terrible misjudgment when it came to Vietnam. You know, what it reminds me of is Joseph Kennedy. Joseph Kennedy was a brilliant businessman. He could see around the corner in the midst of the Depression as to what to invest in and how to earn, make huge sums of money. But when it came to foreign policy, he was an incredible dolt. He just couldn't measure what was the most important facts and vision for the United States. So I think these men, as Doris said, you know, he had this extraordinary domestic impulse, to advance the country, advance the well-being of the country. And he was really so blind when it came to foreign affairs and misunderstood at bottom what he was dealing with initially. You know, Chris, I've had dinner five times, as Doris did too, with President Obama. And we talked to him about Johnson. We talked to him about the Vietnam War. And Vietnam has had a significant impact on his thinking about foreign policy, because Iraq, he told us from the start he was determined to get out of that conflict. And on Afghanistan, he just doesn't want to put in massive numbers of troops. He doesn't see an American foreign policy that involves large forces in Syria. And I think it has an awful lot to do with understanding of and memories of the Vietnam experience.
It's a strange commentary, though, that these presidents, all of them, seem to have to learn that through their own blunder, hitting the wall again. But go back to Johnson's motives for just a sec, Bob Dalek, because you're the historian, the hardcover, serious academic historian who broke the famous story of what motivated Lyndon Johnson. Reporters, as you wrote, and Chris Oppie quotes you on this, reporters have been bugging Johnson to explain why he stuck with this war in spite of so many difficulties, so much opposition. The president then unzipped his fly, drew out his substantial organ, and declared, "This is why." How do we deal with
it? Well, he was a very crude man and could be.
Oh, maybe he was telling the truth.
Well, he was a vulgarian in many ways. And, you know, a president doing such a thing, I mean, it's just ugly. And what does it have to do with rational discourse or explanation?
Zero. What does politics have to do with rational discourse?
Well,
what does war have to do with it?
Yes, often the case. Often the case, or usually the case.
No, but let me just throw it in. I mean, on this point, what would have let him see that coming around with Martin Luther King on the voting rights was Lyndon Johnson at his strongest, and fixating on Vietnam was LBJ at his weakest?
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think his poorest judgment was that if he didn't stay in Vietnam, if he didn't fight that war, both Republicans of every stripe were going to come after him and destroy his Great Society programs. And I think that's false. I think he could have had more of the Great Society, because these wars destroyed domestic reform. They overcome it. You know, it happened. Progressivism was turned off by World War One. Roosevelt said, "Doctor, when the war's been replaced, has replaced Doctor New Deal." Truman's Fair Deal went a glimmering with Korea, and Johnson lost that Great Society in a sense. Not that it was all reversed, but it was called to a halt by the. And he himself said that bitch of a war. It turns me away from my true love, which is the Great Society.
I wonder, so, Christian Oppie, I mean, do you have a notion of how he could have gotten out of the box of his own making?
Well, I have a slightly different view, because Bob Dalek and Doris Kearns Goodwin seem to be suggesting is that LBJ is a kind of blinded, tragic figure who really didn't understand foreign policy or what he was getting into. There were things he didn't understand, but there was also you have to say a serious attention he gave to the war. I mean, he was down in the war room studying the bombing sites, and so this idea that that he might have had too much power, he claimed that power. He reserved it to himself. He didn't want debates in Congress. Now, it's certainly true that he hoped against hope that things might turn around, that we might eventually be able to defeat these guerrillas of a poor country. But other than Walt Rostow, who was perennially and even insanely optimistic, the only one most of the advice he was getting was that the best we could expect, even with all these massive escalations and ruthless bombing, particularly in the South, would be to avert defeat, delay it.
Well, I would say he framed it in mythic terms between the emasculation of leaving the war and the emasculation of losing the war. No way out.
Right, no way. And it really, I do think gender does have causal and explanatory power here. And in that sense, I don't think that LBJ is exceptional. And who knows what Kennedy would have done? I'm not one of those people who is convinced he would have pulled out. I mean, the men who are making American foreign policy in this era had different forms of masculinity, and many of them weren't as crude as LBJ, but they were every bit as sort of ruthless in their understanding of the necessity to assert both personal and national power.
So. Christian Oppie and Bob Dalek, stand by. Coming up, lessons we learn and don't learn in history, with Christian Oppie, Robert Dalek, and Chad Williams of Brandeis, starting with a fragment of Martin Luther King's moral vision that we don't hear often enough. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. 50 years of hindsight on Selma, the first engagement of combat troops in Vietnam, also, both datelined March 1965, and on the protagonists Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King. Dr. King held his tongue to preserve a political partnership until 2 years after Selma, when he said he couldn't bear his own silence about the war. And then he let it all hang out at the National Conference for New Politics in Chicago in April 1967.
Above all, the war in Vietnam has revealed what Senator Fulbright calls our nation's arrogance of power. We are arrogant in professing to be concerned about the freedom of foreign nations while not setting our own house in order. We arm Negro soldiers to kill on foreign battlefields, but offer little protection for their relatives from beatings and killings in our own South. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death.
That was Martin Luther King in April 1967, about a year before he died. Chad Williams is with us in the studio, World War I historian and chairman of African American Studies at Brandeis University. Chad Williams, I'm wondering what had happened to Martin Luther King's imagination, to his understanding, to his moral compass between Selma and that speech?
Well, thank you for sharing that speech. It just gives me chills listening to it because it reminds us just what a true radical King was. We oftentimes have this very sanitized vision of Martin Luther King Jr., one that's frozen in time, one that is trapped in the iconic moment of King at the Lincoln Memorial in August of 1963. We don't think about King as a revolutionary, as a radical, and thinking about him in the context of 1967, of his very courageous opposition to the war in Vietnam, really brings a new level of appreciation for what a remarkable individual he was.
Reminds you what courage is. That's courage.
Certainly. Absolutely. And I think to your question, his evolution is really important to consider as well. After Selma, King was asking the question, what is next? What is the next step in this movement? And I think a crucial moment for King was the Watts riot. He went to Los Angeles after the Watts riot. He walked through the streets. He talked to African Americans who were in despair. He saw the frustration on their faces and realized that he needed to do something to address the systemic poverty, the injustice beyond just the South that African Americans were confronting. And Vietnam was a crucial piece of that. African American men being sent to Vietnam in disproportionate numbers, but not able to enjoy the fruits of democracy in the United States. And I think that was a critical catalyst for why he was able to make that huge, courageous moral leap to speaking out against the war.
Come back to, if I may, the black understanding of LBJ and the contradictions therein, and they sort of surfaced on the edges around this movie. That's not respect for Martin Luther King. It's palpable on the screen, and he was the best friend of Black America since Lincoln. It's a cliche, but I think it's probably still true. And yet, it's a hard man to embrace.
Certainly,
talk about it.
Well, I think you have two visions of LBJ. Certainly, he was a remarkable president in terms of his support for African-American civil rights. You have many African-Americans of the civil rights generation who will say that that LBJ was perhaps an even greater president than Abraham Lincoln in that regard. But I think what the film Selma does so brilliantly is looks at LBJ from a different perspective. It looks at LBJ from the perspective of the grassroots, of the men and women who were in the trenches, so to speak, in Selma, who were on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, who were facing racial terrorism every day, and gets you to seriously question, was LBJ that much of a hero? From that perspective, was he the second coming of the great emancipator? Was he moving fast enough? And I think those are critical questions to ask in terms of thinking about LBJ's legacy and also how we think about history and the history of the civil rights movement specifically. What is the perspective that we take in looking at this crucial period in our history?
Do you mean to ask, was he even then up to the job, up to the depths of this problem?
I would argue that if you were an African American in Selma, Alabama at that time, you did not think that LBJ was up to the task. You did not feel that he was moving fast enough. You know, when there's a need for federal protection, you know, where is LBJ? Right? Is he moving fast enough? And I think those are the questions that the film really gets us to grapple with.
Makes you think about a lot of things. I was shocked by the thunder of those truncheons on helpless people. And I thought, this is Hollywood, or this is exaggerated. Funny, I called up, Roy Reed was the New York Times reporter in the movie. I mean, the guy was playing Roy Reed, a good friend of mine from years ago. And I called him up and I said, Roy, was it that violent? He said, Chris, it was worse, a lot worse.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think what the film does so painfully but also beautifully is capture that violence. And I don't think we have a full appreciation for the type of racial terror that African Americans had to experience in the South during the Civil Rights Movement and, of course, well before the modern Civil Rights Movement, but also the trauma of that violence and how that still lingers with us today.
And of course, the
echoes
irony
of it.
And the connection with Vietnam was palpable, unmistakable, and Martin Luther King articulated it beautifully. So did a number of people in the movie. How in the world could Lyndon Johnson be sending American troops to protect Vietnamese and hesitating about protecting them in Selma, Alabama?
Absolutely, right. And this is a question that African Americans have grappled with for generations. You know, what type of commitment does the country have, does the American presidency have to protecting African Americans and their civil rights? Same questions being asked during World War I, the same questions being asked during World War II. And we certainly see those questions being asked during Vietnam. So there's a grappling.
You hear them being asked, let's be real, about drone war in the Middle East today.
Absolutely, absolutely. So these kind of questions about war, democracy, about protection, these are crucial questions which get at the heart of the very contentious relationship between race and democracy in this country's history.
Christian Nuppy, I'd love to come back to what we lost, what we have lost, and what we've learned in all that time. What sort of awakening do you think sticks? There's a remarkable number in your book. Talk about quotes, but talk. There's a remarkable number of American military men lost in war between 1975 and the year 2000. The last quarter of a century, the number shocked me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to take a guess?
Yeah, I mean...
guess how many?
I can even wager, I guess.
It's less than 800 men.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a month's worth of deaths in Vietnam. Somebody learned something. Maybe just to go aerial.
Yeah. Well, the lesson they learned is that at the very least they understood that the American public in that post-Vietnam period would no longer tolerate an endless, indecisive war that led to high American casualties. So it's not that we sort of became an isolationist nation. I mean, we were intervening all over the place, but we were choosing interventions and wars that could be won quickly with minimal American loss of life. And so there's some interesting anomalies. I mean, Reagan, attacked his predecessors for pulling out of a war in Vietnam that he thought was both noble and winnable. He goes into Lebanon, and 241 Marines are blown up at the barracks in that suicide attack in 1983. And you might have thought he would have doubled down on that, but instead he ended up withdrawing. So there was this period where, as I say, while we were still maintaining, 800 bases around the world and wanted to be the preeminent military power, there was a bit more restraint than there was after 9/11, in which all those sort of constraints that we've come to know as the Powell Doctrine, never fight a war without sufficient, public support with the adequate means, a clear objective and exit strategy, all those things went flying out the window, even for Powell.
I give Ronald Reagan credit for learning his lesson and then going home by way of Grenada, hand out more medals in Grenada than practically in all of Vietnam for beating up a little island, and then let's come home. But you can also be more generous about what the country was learning. I mean, it runs through your book that it was not the elite or decisive opinion, but there was a gut sense among plain people that firing napalm at peasants was an abomination, and that our pro-democracy agenda was a fraud, and that we were at war with our first principles over there. Yes. I mean, give the country some credit.
Absolutely, I do, but I would hasten to add that we'll go to 1971. There was this remarkable poll in which 58% of Americans said the war in Vietnam was not merely a mistake, but immoral. I don't know another instance in our history where that portion of Americans would label an American war immoral. And so I do think to the present, Americans, the public, is far more anti-war than the policymakers. I mean, a majority of Americans have opposed the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2006, and yet the wars continue. And it so raises all kinds of questions. One partial answer is that I just think many Americans feel that this sort of war machine has a life of its own and is kind of impervious to criticism and change, and they can no longer count on their elected officials to generate an open and engaged debate, and so they feel left out and uninformed. And the other thing is we're now relying on a tiny fraction of our population, less than 1%, to fight in our name, presumably to protect our freedoms, all over the globe. And so we've been in wartime, but it doesn't feel like war. It's not a daily part of American consciousness. We can go about our business and without it really affecting us.
Bob Dalek, I want to bring you in before we're cooked here. All of you, really, on what Chris Hoppe has written about a tremendous loss of innocence in the last 50 years. And here we are in 2015 with a stripped-down Voting Rights Act. And in the world at large, we seem to have an acute sense that we're the victims of something. We're armed to the teeth. We profess, at least, to be ready to intervene all over the place. Where in the world are we? You first, Bob Dalek.
Well, you know, we're a mixture, as we always are. I think lessons of Vietnam have been learned. As I said before, President Obama is very mindful of what happened in Vietnam and what a blunder that was. And I think he was also mindful of the great mistake that Johnson made, which is really surprising, that McGeorge Bundy urged him to have a public discussion about what we were doing in Vietnam, that Franklin Roosevelt had been brilliant at building a consensus for American participation in the Second World War. And Johnson needed to address this issue with the public if he were going to sustain the effort in Vietnam. This was Bundy urging him on. Johnson didn't want to have that public debate, and Bundy resigned. He gave up his post as national security advisor. So I think this was another one of those huge mistakes about the war that doesn't get as much attention as the just misjudgment on the battlefield of Lyndon Johnson. But, you know, where are we today? I think we have this incredible mixture of militarism and resistance to adventures abroad. Mm. And we no longer have a draft. Nixon ended that. And the public is doesn't want to stand still for the sacrifice of blood and treasure in one of these adventures abroad. And so Obama certainly feels that. He feels constrained by the current public mood. And I think it's a direct consequence of the failure, the defeat in Vietnam.
Chris Alpea, I got to ask you to be very quick. Where are we? Where are we heading? I like that, you know, up to our neck in militarism and anti-adventurism.
Long-term idealist, but short-term, very pessimistic. I think that our presidents and every principal policymaker continues to be wedded to this notion of American exceptionalism, and at the heart of it, this notion that we are an indispensable nation, a force for good in the world, and I think it's a very dangerous concept. And while I think Americans are more skeptical of that, especially when you ask them about specific issues, our schools, our infrastructure, our Congress, foreign policy, but there still is, even among the public, a broad desire to believe in that idea that we are exceptional in the world.
I think we got to get rid of
that concept.
Got to give Chad Williams the last word.
Sure. Well, I think just as we're living the lessons of Vietnam, we're also living the lessons of Selma. We're at a very interesting moment in this country's history where we're still grappling with issues of civil rights, of the respect for Black lives. And I think we can learn many important lessons from the incredibly brave men and women who put their lives on the line in Selma, and how to build a movement. Building on the legacy of the Civil Rights Movement.
Thank you, Chad Williams. Thank you, Robert Dalek. Thank you, Christian Appy, and Doris Kearns Goodwin, too. We're going out on a song from the movie Selma called Masters of War, written by Bob Dylan, sung by Odetta. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source, and check our website, radioopensource.org, and our Kickstarter campaign while you're at it.
Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. Well, that's the worst fear that can never be heard.